Okay. Well, I've just been in this county all my life. I've frog hunted and gator hunted way back when it was legal to gator hunt, and then over the years we just got into frog hunting and commercial fishing. That's what the frog hunting comes under, is the commercial fishing that I do. And the frog hunting just developed from the early push boaters. You know, we push boated for years and then developed the push. The first airboat was developed just to carry the pole boaters out to where they was going to push boat as a mother boat. Yeah, the pole boat. Pole boat would be the design. And we'd, I didn't use any like that, but the first airboats was used like that. My uncle and the old timers would use one big boat and put four or five push boats on it and use it to haul all everything out, their salt, to salt their hides with, and their supplies and camping gear. And then when they get out to where they was going to hunt, they'd park the big boat and take the little push boats and go hunting. And they'd come back to make coffee and change clothes and whatever, you know, and sleep and rest on the old big boat. And then they learned that they could pick up frogs running the old big boat off the trail on each side. That's what big boats didn't even have a rudder on them, the air rudder. They were guided by pushing the bow of the boat back and forth to keep it in the trail. Yeah, it was a big old sled with an engine on it, yeah. But then they started developing the first boats. First airboats were made just for frog hunting. No one else had them. The mother of necessity caused to be invented, you know. I mean, if there's a need for something, you go ahead and work it out. And that's what the early fellers did. There was probably 40 airboats when I got my first one in the middle 40s. Right after we stopped commercial fishing on Lake Okeechobee, I started frog hunting and gator hunting seriously then, because that was to make a living that way. And then the duck hunters started using airboats. That was the first sportsmen to use the airboats, was the duck hunters. My uncle he left the duck hunt. He was supervisor of registration here in West Palm Beach, DeWitt Updegrove. And in fact, he was the one that was responsible for us having the first airboat club here in the late 40s, early 50s, right in there somewhere when we organized. We seen the need of organizing an airboat because of the fact that the airboats came very near to be non-existent for the public in the state of Florida. Cattlemen Association took a dislike to the early airboats. They didn't want airboats, so they caused legislation to try to go through that would make any part of an airboat like having a piece of liquor still in your yard. That federal. And they were so powerful, they very near did it. If they'd have wanted a simple, reasonable law, they would have got it. But they tried to make it a state and federal law at the same time, so that if there was a piece of airboat in your yard, the federal government come here and arrest you, just like they would if you had a liquor still sitting in your yard, or pieces of liquor still. So, I mean, two friends I met in Miami, P.M. Boyd and J.M. Fields, they were rich people, and I helped build Mr. Boyd an airboat. He owned a chain of hardware stores there. I had moved down to Miami and was doing some plastering for the mackerel company in the early 50s. And he and Mr. Fields went to Tallahassee and blocked this legislation that was going through that would have caused airboats to be non-existent for any of the public. Nobody but officers, game commission, and state officials could have had an airboat if that would have passed. So they had just started duck hunting with airboats a little bit, and they had loved airboats, so they didn't want them to be blocked. So that's the way that came about. So we came back here. When I moved back here, I got Uncle DeWitt interested in forming an airboat club, and he got a couple of our local lawyers here in town to draw up the charter, Clyde Windham and Red Johnson, and they're lifetime members of the association. And us froggers had been trying to form a frogging association, we called it, but it never would get off the ground. It never would get started. and him having the know-how and the people to help him, like these lawyers to help him get it set up, we formed the second airboat association in the state, which was the Palm Beach County Airboat Association. And later the association incorporated half tracks into it, and we were called Airboat and Half Track Association. So it was a hunting vehicle that with like a tractor tracks on it, cleats on it, that you could go into marsh. And so for years there was quite a few of both in the organization. But then the frogging just then in that, about that time, conservation area number one was the most prime area that we hunted. It's similar to Okefenokee number one is. It's got soft spots, big soft areas of deep soft mud similar to what Okefenokee's got. And it was the best frog producing area in the state of Florida, period, with no exception. It was the best. And the early pole boaters hunted out there, but they didn't do much frog hunting. But then when the airboaters got started, the frogs out there would reproduce the fast, and the water would stay the year round pretty well in this deep slush type marsh, where the other marshes would dry up quicker. These would always be the deepest parts that would stay wet, so the frogs seemed to do better there. And I hunted in there 7 or 8 years before the Department of Interior became attracted to the area because of the ducks that was coming into the area. 30 or 40 of us airboaters over 10 and 12 years, the boys that was in before me and then the 7 or 8 years that I hunted out there, did a job that was unequal. It was a great service to the area, the way we had rubbed down all the sloughs around the ridges. Looked like golf courses around the big high wooded ridges. The ducks loved it. The whooping cranes and everything loved it, rubbed down like that. The old big whooping crane would go out in the middle of this big rubbed down place with little and build her big old nest and raise her two little whooping cranes, you know. And she loved it because she wasn't confined in the heavy bushes. But the ducks were the biggest thing. A lot of the fellas would use their airboats every hunting season, duck season. They'd go out and make some up some stands. And then the duck hunters, having no way to get into the marsh, none of them had airboats to speak of at the time, would hire the frog hunters to take them out and put them on the stand early in the morning. Then late the evening, come pick them up, you know. And it got to be real famous duck hunt. Well, that attracted the Department of Interior. They were the duck people, the migratory bird people. And they promised us faithfully that they wouldn't stop the airboating. They were just going to control it and make duck hunting better. And they were going to regulate the area. It's a large area. It's very near the size of Lake Okeechobee, conservation area number one. It probably may be a little bit smaller, but it's very near the same acreage. And we had it a real paradise. Anyhow, the federal people, they reneged on their promise. They never did allow us to go back in and hunt it. And so then we hunt everywhere else that we can. You know, the conservation area number two and three is marshland. Not as good as number one by far, but it's fair at times. And so they agreed in their grit. See, the flood control gave the Department of Interior the lease on the property and the animals and control of it, which I never did think was right, because I felt like the Game Commission should have been involved in leasing control of game. But in the contract that the flood control gave to the Department of Interior, they said that they would allow the harvest of overpopulation of anything, fur-bearing animals or frogs wasn't mentioned, because frogs were not even considered, anybody didn't consider them very much. That was the bottom of the barrel on as far as wildlife was concerned. No one considered them. But they did consider fur-bearing animals. So it just didn't, didn't work out. Well, it's just it's a lot of preparing, just like any trip you get ready to go hunting. There's quite a bit of them. You got to have your everything you're going to need, or your one thing, not having one thing causes you to miss it. The other night, that's a Tuesday night, I started out and I thought I had everything ready. Unloaded my boat and shoved off out into the water. And before I cranked my motor, well, of course, I went to get my headlight because it done got dark. And the bulb was blowed in my headlight. And I reached around for my spare and I didn't have my spare bulb. We use these hydrogen bulbs, these new bulbs that's come out. They're very fine bulbs. And they did last for 6-7 months, one bulb would. And I just carelessly let my supply get down and didn't realize that I didn't have a spare. I thought I had a spare. So I loaded back up on my trailer, loaded my boat up, and came halfway home, and I remembered I had an old reflector with a bulb in it in the glove compartment that I intended to give to my son, that he needed a spare headlight. And so then I went on back and unloaded, and I hunted a couple hours. And well, just your gig and all the, well, you just make sure you got everything you need, like your gig and your headlight and your slicker clothes, you know, and yeah, those some slicker pants over there, regular commercial fishing stuff, and rubber boots is important. I have rubber boots, you know, because if you get stuck, you got to step out, and usually it's hard enough that you're not going to get wet, but you've got to stomp the bushes down, you know, to turn your boat around to get it going back again, to go back where you just came from. That's all. Yeah, that's all you could use. Well, you got a long cord on that light. I can walk 10, 15 foot away from my boat with my headlight because of the long cord we use. Drop. Yeah, it's they've come a long ways. In 1976, there was 50,000 airboats in the state of Florida in 1976. So there's probably five times that many now, most likely, in the state. What really started airboats to being real popular is the manufacturers that started, like Air Gator and Panther Airboat, and the ones that made put millions of dollars in their factory, you know, to like building new cars, you know, they really started turning them out. And in other states all over the United States, and I built several boats that went to Alaska. A friend of mine had moved up to Alaska, and he carried his old airboat up there with him, Till Thompson. And when he realized how much fun there was to play on them frozen lakes and the moose hunt, to go up the creek of the streams and get into the little flats where the moose loves the wet country, so marshy, wet places, the airboats are perfect for that. So one time when he was down here, we built three. I built him three hulls. I used to build the hulls here, aluminum hulls and galvanized bottom, and like several other fellas, Ray Rotenberg built the first Palm Beach style hull, we call them, with a rounded stern, where it used to, they square like a box kind of, and it turned over easy. So he designed the Palm Beach style hull, we call it, with a rounded stern. So it was quite an improvement. And then he carried them piggyback. We just built the hulls, and he set them in one on top of the other, and then he bought an airboat that set in on top of that, and we built up a new trailer. So he had five hulls with one complete boat and all on one trailer, and carried them back to Alaska. And it worked real well. That galvanized bottom slides good on an airboat on ice. Aluminum don't slide too good on ice, but steel, like steel runners on sleds and stuff, work real good. But then fiberglass came in, And that's what I went to, is fiberglass. I quit building hulls myself, even for my own use, because I can buy a hull, a fiberglass hull, for a little bit more than the material it would cost me to build my own boat. And the beauty part of a fiberglass, in my opinion, is when I knock a hole in it, I can patch it, and it don't, the boat don't lose its shape. In other words, you knock a hole, you patch it, and it's good as new, you know, almost good as new. Where a metal boat, when you hit it hard enough to damage it, it's like bending a fender on a car or frame of a car or something. You never get it back out like it was to start with. It'll always have the effects of it. And the time element, most people just would rather buy a hull ready made, factory built hull, than to, and they slide good. Fiberglass will slide on dry ground, where a metal hull needs moisture. Stainless will do pretty good on dry ground, or epoxy painted hull, but the normal metal didn't do too good, not near as good as fiberglass. The fiberglass would slide on stuff much better. So we just went to that. And then about 75, I started dealing with power plant engines, surplus army stuff that they used to run generators, Continental stuff that used generators. Manx and Maxwell in Fort Worth, Texas, used to build our props, our propellers that pushes the airboats. And I dealt with him 15, 20 years. And then finally I went out there and started hauling engines from his place. He would buy army surplus, all kind of engines and parts. And I helped introduce the Continental power plant engine into this country. And at one time that was the famous engine, because it was real cheap. You get a lot of parts for them. The aircraft parts would fit. And still some of them are running, but most of the hunting people, the commercial hunters mostly, the frog hunters mostly went with the power plant, because it was a working man's cheap motor. It would produce a lot of power, up to 8 cylinders, from 4 cylinders to 8 cylinders, all different styles all the way through. And some of all of them are still running. But most people that fool with airboats now are working people that has the money to just go ahead and buy a good lock. The Lockhoman is the premium in motor. It's more compact, more power for its weight than any of the other engines. And it's a high compression engine. That's what I'm using now myself. This is the second one that I've ever owned. I wore out one, and then I got another one, and they do a fine job, Bill. I can ride dry ground and mud and stuff that I used to would never dare go on to with anything else. But these engines we're running now run a lot better, a lot better. Very little pulling I have to do. I go anywhere as I want to go, whether there's water or not, you know, just right out across the top of the bushes, you know. How's that? Yeah. Well, I've got, that's, over the years I've developed sleeping in the daytime. And even in the nights when I don't go hunting, I don't sleep. I just wait till 2 or 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning before I go to sleep anyhow. It's got a pattern that I've worked out that, and I'm semi-retired to where I'm not pressing it. I don't have to punch a clock for nothing. So I just, when I get sleepy, I go to sleep. And when I wake up when I feel like it. But it works good for the hunting. For the first many years that I hunted, it was a struggle and a fight to get home without falling asleep driving. You know, just real tired and sleepy. Many a time I had to pull off side the road and just call myself going to sleep. Of course, I probably wouldn't sleep 2 minutes, but when I did wake up, then I'd be fresh and feel like I'd had a lot of, I'd come on home. But it was bad. I couldn't get regulated, but here in the last 10 years, seemed like it's worked out real good. I finally got into a system of just sleeping late of a morning, going to bed late. When I go hunting, I'll come in, I'll hunt hardly never after 2 o'clock. That's I've hunted from 4 to 6 hours by 2 o'clock, and I've got my catch. And just having the one eye, this one eye begins to weaken on me, and it'll start blurring. I can't see the frog real good. Start riding over and missing a lot of them, and I'm tired too, so I'll go ahead and quit around 1 or 2 o'clock. So I'll come, it takes me an hour to get home usually, and then I'll cut the heads off and ice them down, and she'll get up in the morning. When she gets up after daylight, she'll finish, she'll skin them and clean them and take care of them, and then when I get up 1 or 2 o'clock, they're ready for me to either package them or see if anybody wants them, you know, if I can sell them anywhere. Most of them I've been putting in the freezer against the time when the restaurants all get to going during the peak of the season every year, when the few restaurants that use frog legs will use quite a few right during the season, you know. And then so it's do whatever I have to do in the repair. I leave here about an hour before dark, in time to get to the landing and get unloaded by dark. So when good dark comes, I can start hunting. First dark seems to be one of the best times, because it's after a hot day, the bugs are out good at first dark. And of course the frogs are up getting the bugs, and so that's when I try to be there. And then again, the frogs come up before daylight, the bugs will start flying. Bugs like mosquitoes or anything are real plentiful at first dark and first daylight, and that closest to either one of those periods are when the frogs are out the very best. They're pretty good the rest of the time, unless it rains. If it rains, it wets everything down, and the bugs don't fly good right after a rain. So then you won't get many frogs if the bugs are not up working. And then about 50% of my hunting, since I'm about the only one that seriously hunts, there's not enough for me to keep the area rubbed down, to keep the bushes that grows up so fast, cattails and the marsh bushes. I spend 50% of my time just bulldozing and rubbing down areas so that I can find the, so I can find the frog there later. And in doing that, I create these holes that the duck hunters really love. 5 years I've been hunting in an area now, and each year I notice better and better rubbed out holes. They're getting better and better, because after I knock a trail and carve out a place, then other hunters and other boaters will come in and run those trails. They'll knock very few new trails, but they'll run them trails that's been knocked, which helps. And then the duck hunters, they look like black holes that's been there for centuries to them. They don't realize it. Someone had to get in there and carve them holes out. And very few, well, it's just very few of us left. It's the old timers. Well, I don't know of any other person in this county that does it 100%. There's quite a few younger fellers, younger than I, that works on weekends, and they'll hunt 2 or 3 nights when the frogging is real good, when they can probably do good, you know. Most of all of them works on jobs. Fellsmere has got some old-time hunters. In fact, the Fellsmere area in the St. John's Marsh, this side of Melbourne on the East Coast, they're some of the oldest froggers in the state there. In fact, the first airboats actually came out of Fellsmere. The Lake Worth fellers here were a few years behind building up airboats behind the Fellsmere fellers, my uncle and them. No, he was one of the early designers. Buddy Up the Grove was his name. Yeah, and the Halls, Claude Hall and Frank Hall was about my age, and the Wellmans, Jack Wellman and Earl Wellman and the Rudds, they were a lot of the big family of Rudds that frog hunted. Quite a few of them. I can't think of all their names now, but they was all together, there was probably 50 or 60 of us that was hunting. Matt Blanchard and his family. And of course, Jack and Earl had family that hunted too, you know, so their boys, quite a few boys in each family. Earl Wellman and his, that's right. Yeah, and Buddy's daddy, Buddy Rudd's daddy, was one of the original old timers in the number one. He had probably, I wouldn't doubt, but what, the first airboat in number one. Did you see those pictures? Did you find those pictures that I brought back to him over there? Well, him and his daddy and his mother sitting on the side of this old boat was out in number one, out from the North Landing. And that area had dried up like it did, and the boats were so heavy, them car engines, they didn't bring them out of the marsh. They parked it out in the marsh where they could walk out to it and tote their gas out and walk out to it and go hunting months before the water came on up high enough that they could run from their car to the marsh. So across that dry border that always was created, they'd leave their boats inside the marsh, so to speak, covered over, and let the dry spell go through. And then when the rainy season came, the water started coming up. There'd be water in the low part out here, but it'd still be a month or so before the water would get high enough, if they had their boat at home, to run their boat across this dry border that would be around the marsh that they couldn't get through except on high water. So by leaving his boat in like that, that's the reason they took that picture out in the marsh, because it was dry there. But we didn't use any guards on the early boats. You could see on those pictures, they were just motor with a propeller on it with no guards around the propeller, which was safe enough. The only people that was ever hurt, even under that condition, was when drinking was involved. When somebody that drinking, or a real freakish accident where two boats run together on a blind trail, a curve in a trail or something. Or one fella got killed at the North Landing back when we didn't have guards. We had a trail through the cypress, and the water would be from dry to deep. Well, when the water would get down to where that white sand going through that cypress, the water would be a few inches deep over the white sand. You'd have to get up on a plane and plane through it to keep from grabbing and stopping your boat. Well, it was a narrow trail through the cypress. So if you missed it just a little bit, you'd hit a cypress. You know, I mean, you'd wreck. So two fellas was going through, and one fellas was knelt down in front of the engine, and they was flying through there, and he missed it and hit a cypress, and the engine came over and killed one of the fellas. But normally, when anybody got hurt with an airboat, most of the time it was due to drinking and just careless and drinking. But the Lake Okeechobee's got real good for frogging over the years. Now this algae bloom that's on the lake now, the pollutant that goes into the lake has created good frogs. The hydrilla, which is a curse to this country, is a blessing to the frogs. The hydrilla grass. You know the green grass that you put in an aquarium? That's hydrilla. Well, it's a type of a moss, green moss, grass-looking stuff. It's an exotic that got started in this country. And the spawn can raise and the fish can't get to it. Way back yonder, when I was a young fella, and Lake Okeechobee was almost a crystal lake. I mean, it was clear, and Well, that there was no frog to speak of, because there's no place for them to hide, nothing for them to grow in, you know. And yeah, shut it off. And it's all connected so close. My experience in airboating and frog hunting is connected so close to the Game Commission and the commercial fishing on Lake Okeechobee. They all tie together as far as I'm concerned, you know. Was a 75-year tradition that my granddad and his brother started in the late 1800s. But then in the early 40s, the Game Commission was created. Their biggest purpose to start with was to close Lake Okeechobee to commercial fishing, because there was such a misunderstanding all the way through. But when they were created and stopped the fishing, well, then I went to frog hunting.
Oh, so you originally were from a fishing family?
Oh, yeah.
I see.
I was a...
What did you fish for?
Catfish, mostly. Uh-huh. The Hall Saints were for catfish, mostly. Mm-hmm. And my granddad and his three brothers, the Updegrove brothers, John Updegrove was my granddad. He had a fish house in Fort Myers, but he would come out and camp on Lake Okeechobee and fish, and run boats would go back and forth to Fort Myers, taking the fish and bringing ice and supply back. Well, that was in 1905 and 4. I got a picture in there showing him hanging net and three of his crew members in 1905 under some cypress trees on the lake. Beautiful old picture. But when I write my book, someday I'll use that in it, you know. When I write a book, it'll have the combined the Lake Okeechobee Hall Seining, the Game Commission, the gator hunting, and the frog hunting. Is all connected, to intertwined so close together that it to me it'll all have to come together. Right. They made a mistake when they stopped the Hall Seining, because they're reaping the results of it now in their algae, their over pollution algae
now
bloom and stuff.
Wide net work, isn't it?
Yeah, the Hall Seining was a 1 mile, 1600 yard net. And it was designed just to catch catfish. Scale fish wasn't worth bringing out of the water. Just like trash fish is not worth anything now, scale fish was worth very little. 2 cents a pound right up to World War II was all you could get for scale fish. 7 cents a pound
scale
for catfish. That's brim and speckle perch.
Uh-huh.
Catfish only brought 7 cents up to World War II. But during World War II, when meat became rationed, fish was never rationed. The price of fish doubled. It got up to about 15 cents a pound for catfish to the fishermen. Now, the markets, of course, got maybe 35, 40 cents, you know, but I mean, that was the wholesale price for the fishermen. But the Game Commission, in stopping the lake, they destroyed a 75-year tradition of Hall Seining that was unexcused. I mean, there was really no excuse for it. In 1970, legislation appropriated money for a study as to how and what to do to better our water conditions in South Florida. So in 1972, a report was published. They called it the Governor's Conference on Water. The 50 top scientists of the southern states put this study together. And then in that study, there was one full page saying what should be done for Lake Okeechobee. Now, this was in 72. In the early 50s, when the Game Commission was created, I had a brand new Hall Seining outfit. I was 20 years old, fished it 5 days, and then I was bankrupt. So from early 40s to the 70s, we had no net fishing. But during that whole period of time, that 30-odd years, there was never a day that I didn't. If I found someone that would talk about it, I would tell them what I felt that they had done wrong, and I felt that that program should have never been stopped. So I really worked. So when 72, when that report come out, I realized that there was a chance of getting the net fishing back, because them scientists said that the only way to improve water in Lake Okeechobee was to restore the traditional haul seining. 40 or 50 outfits that was fishing on the lake, 400 or 500 people directly involved in the fishing. And what they said was the annual input of nutrient that came into the lake from agriculture and everything, that nutrient trapped in fish, the normal amount of fish that would be taken out by traditional haul seining, would reduce 17% of the annual nutrient input that come into the lake every year. It was an open and shut, a positive scientific study. So that gave me hope that, well, look, we can get this thing back in the lake again. And so the Florida Wildlife Federation, which I was a charter member, I was a member of that about 20 years then, since the Airboat Association first started. We all affiliated ourselves at being a small club with the Federation, Florida Wildlife Federation, with environmentalist people, fine people. And so the director, Johnny Jones, he's the one that showed me the report. I may have seen it later, but he didn't realize I used to commercial fish. And boy, when I seen that, that's like throwing gas on a fire, you know. I said, look, that's, I believe, what we've always needed. I think we can take that report now. And sure enough, I went from 72 to 76, we got the program going in 76, 4 years later. And most of that period, right up until the last 6 months, I had absolutely no help from any of the fishermen, anybody. Everybody said I was butting my head against the wall to try to get net fishing back in Lake Okeechobee. That had been stopped for 35 years, and there was no way they was going to let haul seining go back into the lake. But I felt different. And the Game Commission, it was hard to get them to warm up to the proposal. I drew up the proposal that they finally adopted about conditions. But I give too much. I compromised and handicapped the commercial fishermen to such a point by saying that we wouldn't fish within a mile of the shore. Well, I was desperately trying to get a foot in the door. I didn't realize the harm that would do to the operation. I learned later that on Lake Okeechobee, there's a few hot spots on the lake where fish naturally congregate. And so I was excluding those spots, and I didn't realize it. But anyhow, one of those spots is my granddad's old haul ground between Cream and Ritter. I fought for that, but no one else wanted to haul same. Anyhow, that's a long, different story altogether. I don't want to get into that, because it was not...
So once the haul seining was basically taken away,
yeah, then
you turned to frog and gator.
Frog and gator, because
how did you learn how to do that?
Well, I'd my early ancestors, uncles and all, were early hunters. Other people in Florida were natural hunters, gator hunters.
How come?
The most of your native Florida people, when I was real small, I'd go with different uncles. They'd get a boatload of gators. I'd just go along for the ride, you know, real little, and pole boating. These old big fish boats, they'd pole them around Lake Okeechobee. I remember one time, three grown men, I went with them, and they used an old seine boat and started at Sand Cut, poling around the edge of the bulrush, poling that old big boat. Didn't have motors. Kickers wasn't even thought of. If they were, you had to be a millionaire to own one. And I remember they loaded that boat down just literally to all it would hold. It was just gators, just one right after the other. Carbide light for a headlight. You'd put a few grains of carbide and a few drops of water and light it, and it'd start to generate gas, and you'd have your pretty good light. And I can remember that just as good as, you know, because it's really stuck in my mind. And then in hall seining, before they stopped us from hall seining, one time we got about a 7-foot gator in our pocket, which was happened every once in a while when you bait a spot for catfish. And when you lay your net around before daylight to catch these catfish, once in a while there'd be a gator out there eating on that bait. So you wouldn't know it because you disturb everything. He stayed down, and you put him in the pocket. And then when you're dipping the fish out of the pocket, after a while, when you confine him and tighten him up, he'll pop his head up then. Well, there he is in the pocket. So it's about a 7-foot gator. And I was getting to be a pretty big boy then, 15, 16 years old. I killed the gator with our hammer that we drive our stake with, drug him in the boat.
Is that how you normally kill them?
No, you usually shoot him with a little 22 or something. Most he's not hard to kill, but hit him in the right spot, you know. And so I skinned that gator. And my stepdad, Leonard Williams, he showed me how to skin it. I'd never skinned a gator before. And I think they was worth 15 cents a foot.
Now, how do you skin a gator?
With a pocket knife, and very carefully you go across down each side, you know, and the very extreme back of the gator's no good. But from this side all the way around to the other side is good leather that they build boots and pocket boots and shoes and stuff out of. And that was another thing. The Florida Audubon people decided that they didn't want alligators to be harvested. So they pushed the hardest. They finally got it stopped. In fact, they finally got the alligator put on the endangered species for the federal government, which was the biggest mistake that they should. They were never endangered, not from hunting. They were endangered from development, condo builders, developers, drying up a marsh and going in there and clearing that marsh and putting golf courses and developments on that marsh, like they did all over. I can name hundreds of places everywhere where they've done that. Go in there with bulldozers and literally cover up all the gators, caves, gator holes, and cover them up and plant sugarcane over the top of them, you know. But the biologists admit now, at least in private, that us so-called poachers, us hunters, were the only friends the alligators ever had, ever. We were doing a management job that was unequal to anything. Nature, gators in the wild, an egg hatching under normal weather conditions will develop male gators 90%. There'll only be 10% of those gators that'll be females if hatched in the wild under the fast changing temperatures. Cool, of a coolish side. They learned this by taking eggs and putting them in an incubator on the gator farms. It's going real strong now. And I helped push for them real hard to help to get the gator situation like it is. By keeping that temperature on the warm side, hatching that egg, it'll be opposite. It'll be 90% female by using the warm temperature, and versus the 10% then will be males. So in a gator farming operation, you want females because them's going to be, you want breeders until you finally get to the point to where you can start cropping off some because you'll have enough to, stock, brood stock. So they admit, and us hunters then, you see, before I was ever old enough to hunt, the gator hunters was real prominent, real strong industry in the state of Florida, in the southern states. The Spaniards, I guess, started it. When they came in, they killed gators for self-defense just to be able to get out of their boats and come ashore, period. But the hunters, the hide, begin to take hold, and the alligator leather is superior to any other leather, and it's in value and in strength and everything else. So it developed real good. And the hunters, real early, by hunting, the normal way to kill gators was with a headlight, either with a pole boat, later with an airboat and kicker boats, but noise making with a light. So real early, way before I ever thought of, the female gators, nature built in a self-preservation thing with the female gators. To where they would sink before, they would sink from the noise and vibration long before the light ever got there. That 10% of females that was in the marsh were just naturally trained not to be killed. And so in an area where she raised her bunch, several bunches, all different, there'd be three different years, the gator's still there with her. When she sank, we'd come in, well, they're here just 90% males, the big old dumb ox, they'd stand up there and look at you and fight at you and everything else. So we'd crop off a few of them. Well, to get her, we'd have to literally pump that hole out. I mean, she's going to stay there until we leave, period. So we'd never bother them. So we're cropping off the enemies that was eating up all the little ones. So by doing that, we developed a terrific management thing that was going, and every year the gators were getting many times more developed, faster and faster. The harder we hunted, the more gators they were, simply because every time we killed one male gator, that one gator that we killed would literally save the lives of thousands of other little ones that he would eat. So it just took care of itself. So then when, even with all the drying up of the habitats and squeezing down to a small percentage of the marshlands left, there were still more gators than there ever were before because it was a man-made situation. Conservation area number one, when they, in the 50s, when they stopped us from frog hunting in there, we were gator hunting right up, or strong in the 50s. We thought in that marsh, I really thought, and the other hunters we talked about, we really thought we had killed every big gator in that marsh, because we'd never see a big one. But we didn't stop to think that everywhere as we went, we'd see literally thousands of little ones, all sizes, up to the 3-foot size, that we'd start cropping them from 3 foot on. We didn't realize what was really happening. We realized that what we was doing was keeping the males thinned down, and the females were naturally staying away from us. And they were hatching off their big crops every year, and they were just getting thicker and thicker. So when they took us out of there in the 50s, everything in there was about the same. They were all little ones, from 1 foot to 3 foot, all little ones. So they raised up together. Now then, that's what's out there now. The 12, 13, 14 foot gators are those little ones, and they're literally wall to wall, from one side of the marsh to the other, giant gators. Now them same females that's always been there are still there. And every year they'll hatch their 40, 50 little ones, but none of them ever survive. After this crop that we left growed up and got big enough to eat up everything that's littler than they are. So every year, millions of gators gets wasted and ate with these bigger ones every year. The state of Florida is losing a wealth and a renewable natural resource, which is the alligator hide, compared to Louisiana's oil wealth. We're literally washing it down the drain and looking the other way and saying it don't exist, to the point of it's ridiculous. And it'll always be that way until, in the year 2000, their lease runs out on conservation area number one. It would really be fine if the state would not renew either one of the 15-year options that's available to the Department of Interior. And if I can ever get to where I can afford it to take a trip to Washington, I went one time when we was trying to get number one open and spent 3 days up there lobbying and talking to them. I believe just by myself I could go there no more than I know about lobbying and knock on some doors and plant the seed that would cause the part of the interior to be kicked out of number one, and it give back to the state and utilized like it should be utilized, the land. It's not right, in my opinion, for a few rich Audubon people to sit back and dictate what should be done to a piece of state-owned property that really belongs to all of us. We should study it and let our biologists decide. If they say it's going to go backwards to have a preservationist attitude, then so be it. Go in there and harvest. If they say that preservation is the right way to go, then that's, of course, we do what our scientific studies tells us to do. Don't do what individuals' personal feelings wants to do, that really shouldn't go by personal feelings on a subject that they know absolutely nothing about. We should listen to the people that studies it, that knows the situation from a scientific part of it. What do you were supposed Japan would do with a renewable natural resource like that? You think they would bury their head in the sand and allow it to be destroyed? They'd do just like they've done with everything else. They'd better their living. They'd better themselves with it. And we could. The fishing on Lake Okeechobee, the tons and tons and tons of fish that needs to be took out of that lake, taking nutrient out, could be utilized in fish meal plant, fertilizer, feeding alligators, or just whatever, to turn around and make more of whatever thing. The first year I fished on Lake Okeechobee, I brought 1 million pounds of shad out. 1 million pounds. And that was in the year from 76 September to 77 September. Well, the 200 trawlers that they legalized, the thing that really killed the program, was a commercial trawler that never, outlaw trawl, that never been legal in history. They legalized it. That killed any chance of ever having haul seines. I and a close friend and family tried to haul seine, but we was bucking 200 little shrimping outfits with diesel motors, fast pulling boats that were prop washing fish into a shrimp net, killing everything that went in, dumping everything overboard except what they wanted to sell. Everything else went back overboard. Those 200 had the capability of catching the 1 million pounds just like I caught in the course of a year, but they brought none of it ashore. They dumped it all back overboard and just kept what they was going to sell, which was ridiculous. The Game Commission, I've argued and argued with them that they shouldn't allow that. Told them to start with it, that's what would happen, and they argued to me that they'd put all the law enforcement, they'd get the National Guard if they needed them out there to make that law stick. A year later, they admitted to me, and it's on the minutes, that they absolutely could not force those trawlers to bring those fish in. So 10 years has went by with the capability of each permittee bringing 1 million pounds apiece. We have wasted 10 years. That's the biggest responsible for that algae that's blooming on the lake right now. I mean, I know myself, in the 10 years, I could have brought 10 million pounds of just pure stink shad. He's a large fish that eats nothing but algae and mud. The nutrient that would come out in that 10 million pound of shad, just myself, would have been tremendous. But of the 200 permits, there was never more than 50 of those people at any one time fishing. 150 of them were just wanting them so they could sell that permit for $500 for somebody to make money. That was a thing that the Game Commission created that I argued hard against from doing it that way. But them 50 of them, and one of me, but 50 of them, each one of them taking 1 million pounds for 10 years, we wouldn't have near the nutrient problem that we got now on the lake had they allowed it to went like I fought so desperately for it to go. And it ain't too late still. They've killed haul seining per se. They've got 10 permits on the lake now. They took my permit away from me a year ago from skullduggery. They arrested my son for fishing in an area too close to the hill, they said. Well, these other fishermen were fishing closer than he was, but they never bothered him. They bothered my son because his name was Paget, because they were mad with me for getting the program on the lake. To start with law enforcement.
Back up, because I'm confused what you're talking about.
Okay, well, that's an efficient thing. They in 76, from 72 to 76, we got the program, the Hall Sanding program going. Well, law enforcement did not want that program on the lake.
They didn't want Hall Sanding on the lake?
The Hall Sanding on the lake, they didn't want it. It was a bother to them. They were perfectly happy to stay in their air-conditioned cars and drive that lake around checking fishing license to people. And that's all they had to do at that time. But when the net fishing was recreated, that meant they had to get out on the lake and do their job. They didn't want that. But not only that, Chief Law Enforcement Officer out of Tallahassee was stationed once in his younger days in Lakeport trying to stop the illegal trawling, the illegal fishing. And he was harassed real bad by those boys that lived in Lakeport, threatened and abused. It was unreal what they did to him, and it should, of course, never have been done. But then they made it clear that little settlement there didn't want no gay board living there. They come into his house when he'd be gone, terrorize his wife, take a can of 5 gallon can of old soupy tar and pour it all over his furniture, and just, I mean, terrible stuff. Well, he became real bitter against that little clique of fishermen, and I don't blame him for being mad. That was a terrible thing to do. I didn't know this until later. But he told them all. I thought he was a friend to me. I used to know him down in the Glades when he first, Mr. Jernigan. He's younger than me. Jimmy Jordan. And he'd worked his way up to Chief Law Enforcement Officer in Tallahassee. So when I was fighting for this program, when I'd meet all of the staff and all of them up in Tallahassee there, we'd sit around in our meetings and drink coffee when we was visiting after when we wasn't having our meetings. And I didn't know that there was any animosity towards me from him. But in 76 in Fort Lauderdale, the Florida Wildlife Federation, the Game Commission would hold their annual meeting at the end of the yearly convention together. The Wildlife's Convention, it was held once a year, would coincide with that September meeting of the Game Commission. It'd be a 5-day event, and we'd always hold it at a big hotel in a resort area, at one of the areas, Jacksonville, Miami, or St. Petersburg, or somewhere. So it just happened that this was in Fort Lauderdale, and after that day, when the Game Commission dotted the final I and said, okay, we'll start fishing the 1st of October with the nets. That night, in the hospitality room where everybody was, there was more drinking that went on at those big conventions, and I never cared anything about drinking. During the years when I was lobbying with them, I'd go in and party with them and drink with them and try to get my point across, but that, quick as that happened, I never drank any more with them because I had no reason to try to lobby or associate with them. I didn't like the drinking, period. To me, that was a waste of time. But at that drinking party that night, when he got pretty full, he let it all out. He told Johnny Jones, the director of the Florida Wildlife Federation, what a no good SBI was for getting that program pushed, ramming it down his throat, he said. And he told Johnny that no matter what it took, he was going to get me. Johnny's wife heard him, and other people heard it. Johnny came to me and said, do you know Jimmy hates you? I said, no, not really. I said, he told me what he said. I said, well, wasn't he drinking? Oh, yeah, he was pretty full. I said, well, that's just old drunk talk. I said, but I still didn't know that he had had that bad experience with them commercial fishermen in Lakeport. But he said there that all commercial fishermen were no good, that he didn't want nothing done on that lake towards helping commercial fishermen. Yep. 7-8 years later, well, 9 years later, almost to the day, is when they took my permit. I was offered $15,000 for that permit, just the use of that permit, which was perfectly legal to sub it out to someone and let them use it. That's the way they're doing it. But one fellow on the lake that owns a permit that's actually out there now fishing his permit, he subs it out to a fish house or somebody else that wants to fish. And the terrible way for the game commission, I told him, I said, that is wrong. I said, the 200 trawl permits you put out for $50 a piece, you wound up having 25 or 30 of those people that were actually fishermen that wanted them to fish. The rest of them stood in line and bought them. We had people that was against the program to buy the permit and just hold it so no one couldn't fish it. That kind of thing. I said, don't do it that way. I said, let free enterprise take care of it. Sell everybody a $50 permit. Sell everybody a $100 Hall of Fame permit that wants it. You're not going to have but just true fishermen on the lake anyhow. So don't complicate it and don't create a black market thing by just putting a special few number and then allowing people to farm them out to one another. So they created it. So in 80, I hurt my back, chipped the disc off in my back, and I haven't fished on Lake Okeechobee since 1980. So I let a fisherman in Lakeport